You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 33. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we talk about archaeological conferences. What are they? When are they? And how can you go?
Let's dig a little deeper. All right. Welcome to the show, everybody. Happy New Year, April.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Yeah. So this should be the first, if all went to plan, this should be the first episode of 2018 that's been released, because our last episode was right before the end of the year. So we squeezed that one in. But I think we've got another good year of episodes coming up, and we'll see where it goes. Again, if anybody ever has anything they want to know about, or any ideas or suggestions for topics or interview ideas, send us along your email. You can email me at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or find us on all the socials at archpodnet. So, but today we are going to talk about conferences, specifically pretty much archaeology conferences, because this is the archaeology show. So let's first talk about what a conference is. And I think maybe April and I will tackle this in two halves. You know, we'll talk about like major conferences and maybe smaller conferences and different kinds of conferences that you can have. So we'll include the type, what a conference is, and the types of conferences in one discussion. I'll kick it off. There's generally for archaeology, I want to say three, although some would say four major conferences for archaeology in the country. Oh, wait, maybe. Yeah, maybe there is just three. Anyway, I'm going to go maybe four major conferences total in the country as far as archaeology type things are related. That's the Society for Historic Archaeology, which April is going to, as we're recording this in a few days, as you're listening to this, it was last weekend, if you're listening to this when it released. There's the Society for American Archaeology conference, and that's probably the biggest archaeology-specific conference in the nation, if not the Western Hemisphere, if I'm not mistaken. It's pretty massive. They get 3,000 to 6,000 people there every year, so it's pretty big. And then there's the, again, this is why I was kind of sketchy on how many major conferences there are, but the American Cultural Resources Association has their conference, ACRA it's called, in, I guess, August, September. I think it's usually in September. I've actually never gone to that. I don't know anyone that has, but I know they typically get about 1,000 people there, and it's supposed to be a big conference for cultural resource management firms and regulation and things like that, and to talk about those sorts of ideas. I'm really interested in going, but it always conflicts with something else I do in September, and I never get to go. So, and then the other one I said is also kind of a maybe, which I was just at the beginning of December and in November, is the American Association of Anthropology. Now, admittedly, anthropology is four different fields. It's cultural, biological, archaeology, and linguistics. However, I even heard somebody say this, like specifically say this at the AAA's this year, that it's like 90% cultural anthropologists. However, there is a small archaeology track if you want to find it, but it's a massive conference in itself. I mean, it's bigger than the SAA's, I know that, and it's just a massive, massive amount of people, but it's mostly cultural anthropology with a little bit of archaeology. So, April, why don't you talk about some of the other types of conferences that we have out there?
Chris, you've definitely covered most of the big ones. You know, there's always a couple of international ones, too, if that's mm-hmm. something you're interested in. I think one of the coolest is the World Archaeology Congress, and they do a conference every couple of years. It's not an annual conference like a lot of conferences are. It's periodic, but they're global. So it's an interesting chance to meet archaeologists from all over the world. But yeah, there's a lot of small local and regional conferences. And, you know, those are great places to meet people who are doing archaeology in your area. Or your specialty, you know, a lot of the subdisciplines, you know, there's a bioarchaeology conference, and that's targeting people who do biological archaeology and are looking at human remains specifically. And so I think it's kind of nice. It's a lot like we talked about in our last episode, where there's a conference for everyone and a conference for every subdiscipline. And I, in some ways, I like those smaller conferences. You know, I really like going to the SAA's, so the Society for American Archaeology conferences every year, but they're big. Meanwhile, the Society for Historic Archaeology conferences are a lot smaller. You get to know more people. You can run into people a little bit more often. And so, you know, the regional conferences, the California Archaeology Conference, it's small. You get to see mm-hmm. people, you get to meet a lot more people. So I think in some ways they're like a great gateway conference, if you will. An entry into the world of archaeological conferences is to go to some of these regional ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we'll get into how you can go and who can actually go to some of these in a little bit here, but actually in a minute. But what I want to say is these bigger ones, they are really good for, I think, just about anybody to go because they are so big, because they're, you can get lost there. I mean, I've found out, you know, weeks after I was at a major conference like the SAAs or something like that, that somebody I knew and probably would have wanted to talk to was actually there, but we never once crossed paths because, God, I'll never forget the Orlando SAAs. And I think the Sacramento one too in 2011, they were so, the building that they had them in was so confusing. Like it usually takes the first day of running around trying to find the room you want to be in to just figure out the layout. If you ever actually figure out the layout, sometimes it's just impossible. There's different floors and buildings and areas, and there's escalators all over the place in these conference centers. The easiest one to navigate, I think, was the one I went to in Hawaii, Waikiki. It was just like one huge area with like rooms around the side, and it was kind of neat. But, anyway, these big conferences, I think you can go and sit in and learn a lot about very specific things because that's kind of how the sessions are set up. I would just wonder, I wonder how people would be received at some of the really small ones. And one of the things I'm thinking is like the Nevada Archaeological Association. We have a conference every year and there's maybe 50 to 100 people that show up at that. And literally everybody knows everybody. You know, it's just like a class reunion practically because it's a small, I mean, we're a big state, but it's a small field. And if somebody were to come in that was just some, you know, somebody nobody knows, and if they're not an archaeologist, people might look at them and go, what are you doing here? Even though you pay your dues and you can go, they might actually question that, which would be weird. And the other thing I would caution too is, I would caution conference organizers about this is, typically I've heard of a lot of relatively confidential information given out during paper presentations at conferences because they assume everyone in the room is part of the profession, but that's not necessarily the case. And that's where we get into who can go and who can go to a conference. Cause you don't have to be a professional necessarily to go to these. If you go to the website for 90% of these conferences, I can't think of one where you can't. And you just pay your dues, pay some membership dues, fill out a form. It asks you what your affiliation, all it is, but I don't know if anyone that's ever been not granted membership, and you fill out a form, you pay your dues for the association, then you pay your dues for the conference, and you can go. And they even have like guest, I know the SAAs has guest tickets, I guess, non-affiliated yeah. tickets and things like that. They might be more expensive, but you can still go and have access to the entire conference.
Well, and I haven't been to as many of these smaller conferences, but I've always thought that they'd be fairly receptive to kind of advocational archaeologists.
And I think they are, if that's actually what you are, you know, if you're like an interested person, maybe you're part of a historical society or a local archaeology group or something like that. But the danger with some of these more local ones is that, I mean, you actually have like legit looters that could come there, legit pot hunters and legit people that are just looking for sites to go hunt artifacts on. I think that's a little more scary, fear mongering. And I don't think it happens as much as we think it does. I mean, that's a lot of effort to go through to hit up a conference, like a small regional, just to find sites, you know, there's way easier ways to do that.
I'm just enjoying your archaeological fear mongering here.
I'll tell you what.
Ben snuck into our conference and they dressed like us. We thought they were us, but they were not us.
He had a whip and everything. It was crazy. No, that's the funny thing though. Anytime we talk about the quote, the public coming into anything that we're doing, the first thing somebody says is looters. So I had to bring it up before somebody else did and was like commented on us. Honestly though, I think the problem of, I think we have more to gain from putting our message out there and letting more and more people hear it than accidentally telling a looter where our site is. You know, I think that's unlikely.
Yeah. And I think, how do I say this? I think especially for the large conferences, the people who are willing to pay the money to come and to sit through some very, very interesting sessions and some sessions that are slightly less interesting, you know, they're people who are truly interested more than people who are out to harm mm-hmm. archaeological resources. And, you know, I think the same goes for a lot of these smaller conferences. It takes a commitment to track them down and to come and to sit through all of these sessions for the potential grain of information you may or may not gain.
Right.
But they, you know, that's kind of my thought on that is it could happen and it may happen and mm-hmm. it has happened. But you're right. What is the loss if we aren't willing to kind of open up these sessions mm-hmm. and share the academic knowledge that we're creating? And, you know, we've talked about this in past podcasts where what work that we do is often partially publicly funded.
Right.
You know, and so it's nice to find these venues and to use these conferences as a way of communicating with ourselves, but especially these smaller regional conferences where, you know, someone may be interested because they saw the work being done on their way to work every day. Mm-hmm. And now they're getting to come to this conference, hear the professional papers, really kind of see the end results. I think that's really important for us to be able to communicate.
Yeah, I think so. And that is, I mean, a conference presentation is the end result for a lot of work, you know, that might not make it into a publication or maybe, I mean, I've seen presentations on some relatively minor things, quite frankly. And that conference presentation is probably the only way that that material was presented. If they produced a report or even a book or another publication or something out of that, it was probably changed and modified and added to or taken away from or something like that. And the conference presentation ends up becoming a truly unique experience for whatever that person is presenting. And also, you know, back on the looter track real quick. I've approached some of the bigger organizations about podcasting these conferences and, you know, actually just recording the presentations and putting them out as podcasts, even if they're just on the association's website. I mean, ideally they'd be public. A lot of European conferences are actually, and a lot of non-archaeology conferences are actually videoed and or audio recorded and available for the public. You know, you still pay to go to the conference, but some of our organizations think that either A, fewer people would go if they knew it was going to be available online, and then they wouldn't be able to afford to have the conference anyway. If not enough people go, they can't afford the venue, and then the conference doesn't happen. So, but then also, they're afraid of information getting out there that the authors of the papers maybe didn't want to get out there. And I'm like, listen, if you put it out at a conference, this isn't a closed like room. This isn't a small thing where you vetted the audience. You have no idea who's in that audience. You know, if you're worried about this information getting out before you're ready to publish it, or if you're worried about sensitive information getting out, you probably shouldn't be presenting that at a conference if you're actually worried about it getting to the public, because people are live tweeting these conferences every day, you know, snapping pictures of the screen and putting those up on Twitter and social media as you're giving your presentation. And that's just a fact of life. And that, on top of the fact that you don't know who's in the audience, you know, means that I think we should just get over ourselves and record these things. And then, you know, I'm hoping there's a day when you don't actually, you know, need to go to the conference. If you just want the information and you don't want to network, which is really what conferences are for, then you can get that in another way. But we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, I was going to say that this is actually a really interesting segue into why, in my mind, people go to conferences, mm-hmm. which is to network. I mean, I go to share research that I'm doing that maybe isn't ready to be published, hasn't been published, or I want feedback on. Mm-hmm. And so I go to share that research and get kind of commentary from my peers and people who are working in related fields who might have ideas that I wouldn't think of. But you also really go to network. And I think that's something that can never be replaced by, you know, the online facilities. It's harder to network. And I think for a lot of people, whether you're a professional archaeologist or just someone who's passionate about archaeology, that's the biggest reason to go to a conference, is to be able to hear someone talk about work that they're doing and be able to walk up to them and say, I loved it. Tell me more about this, or here's why I'm interested, or here are my thoughts on what you just said. And I think that for me is the biggest reason to go to a conference, is those really unique face-to-face interaction moments that can happen in a really casual setting. It can happen in a bar that evening. It can happen in some of the formal settings that conferences arrange, where you get a chance to meet people and really talk to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the primary reason I go to conferences now. I mean, I remember the first The first major archaeology conference I ever went to was the SAAs in St. Louis in, I think, 2010. And I was in grad school and I was so excited. I'd never been to the SAAs before and went up there in a bunch of kind of carpooled with a few other people from grad school. And it was interesting. I got the program ahead of time, of course, and I had down to the minute my schedule every day. And I was jumping from room to room. I didn't realize that after like the second paper, they wouldn't be on time anymore. Like, I realized that. So I saw the middles of lots of papers, but like never the beginning and sometimes the end. Yeah. And I don't do that anymore. I go to conferences. I'm lucky to go to any papers. If I go to any, it's because I was asked to go to hear somebody's presentation specifically, or, you know, I'm supporting somebody who, you know, wants to get it out there, or actually I've been asked to record other people's and actually put it out as a podcast. You know, we just record them straight up, no editing, and throw it right out there. And, that's why I go now. And those hallway conversations you have, those conversations at the bar or in the lobby or wherever it is, are really, really beneficial for the conference. And I make lasting relationships, whether it's business or, you know, personal or professional, from those interactions. So it's pretty great.
Maybe this is a great moment to segue backwards a little bit and tell people who are not archaeologists what is at an archaeological conference, because I've been to some museum conferences and they're different.
Yes.
The types of things that are there. So I think that our conferences may not be the same as a conference for someone who does business management.
Right. And that's a good point. Let's get into that after the break. So just like conferences, you're going to hear an ad for our membership site and the membership side of things. But just like conferences, you don't need to be a member to enjoy the APN as you're listening to this podcast now. But if you want a little extra, like you would get from a conference, then you can go become a member of the APN and we'll send you a little extra. I actually just sent out a box of goodies today to somebody in Maine. So it was it's pretty fun to do that. And I really like sending off our coffee mug and stickers and shirts and stuff. So if you want your own, go to arcpodnet.com/members, as the ad is about to tell you. And there's a mistake in the ad, which I'm correcting, that says you get a 15% off our future store. Well, we have a store and it's 20% off. I increased it. So if you're a member, you get 20% off the store all the time. And that's pretty great. All right, back in a second.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to arcpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to arcpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Well, welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 33. We are talking about conferences, and before we left off, we were just realizing that we haven't actually talked about what is at an archaeological conference and what the different components are, and that depending on what field you're coming to archaeology from, they may be completely different. So archaeological conferences are really more about research sharing, I would say. They're generally organized around papers and presentations or posters that people independently submit or which are solicited into kind of organized groupings. So you could so there's sessions of papers that are thematic. You know, maybe there's a session on World War II underwater archaeology. And the people who organize it go out and they ask a bunch of people who do research on that topic to present a paper that's about 15 minutes in length about their research on World War II underwater archaeology. And then there'll also be people who just randomly have a really interesting topic. They submit it to the conference organizers and they get kind of grouped together with other people who are roughly similar. So those are always fun sessions to go to. I get stuck in a lot of random ones sometimes if I'm not careful. Doing children in recent past really just throws everyone. So there are these paper sessions, and those are really where you go to hear people sharing data. And then sometimes people don't want to do a paper. And papers are basically someone standing there, often with a PowerPoint, and either talking about their research or reading a written paper. And they can be the most phenomenal thing you've ever seen, or they can be a little dry sometimes, depending on who it is. It's a fact of life, unfortunately. But then there are also poster sessions, and these are printed posters that share research visually. So if a topic's very visual, has a lot of graphs and charts, beautiful images, sometimes people will choose to do a poster instead of a presentation. And so the author of the poster or authors often stand there and you can go up and talk to them, read their posters, interact with them. And then, of course, there's the best part, which is the exhibit hall. And this is where people are selling books on different topics. Organizations are promoting themselves. So the APN often has a table at conferences where we're telling people about who and what we are and trying to get new contributors, trying to interview people. And there are different vendors who might sell specialized equipment. And I think that's actually a feature that's pretty universal across all of the different types of conferences from different fields I've been to, are these, you know, is the vendor hall. So if I've forgotten anything, Chris, what else am I leaving out about what's at a conference?
No, I don't think so. Aside from all the different places people go to network, you know, if it's at a resort, like it was practically at Disneyland in Orlando, there's always these little bars and restaurants and things where people are, gathering to have conversations. And you just need to find out where those are and stay social and keep the networking going. Because like I said in this first segment, I think they're all about networking these days. Because, you know, something you said, April, that made me think, you know, it really is a place to present research. And I got to thinking, I wonder how that came about. And I think we've been having conferences for a really long time. This one coming up for the SAA is I think the 81st or 82nd. I don't know. I think it's the 81st. I don't know. It's in the 80s though. So over 80 years, we've been having this conference, and the SAA, the AAA's is even longer. And it's always been, in the past, I think it was a way for people who don't have ability to communicate with each other very well. They didn't have things like Skype and necessarily even phone calls that were cheap to talk, you know, across the country to somebody or across the world. So they'd meet up every once a year at these conferences to present their research to people. And nowadays, I don't feel like we really need to do that. I feel like people are putting out a lot of their stuff in like a blog format or something like that. And there's a whole bunch of discussions online with grad students trying to justify their blogs as research and as publication, you know, because it's publish or perish in the academic world. And they're trying to get their academic style blogs recognized as academic publications and part of their portfolio and not just something they're doing for fun on the weekend. So, and there are some really well-researched blogs out there too with references. And I mean, they're just like a paper in any academic journal. They're just not peer-reviewed, you know? Well, that's what academics think. They're peer-reviewed in the comments, trust me. Because if somebody doesn't like what you say, they'll let you know about it. but that being said, I think I've been to a few different conferences this year. I've been going to archaeology conferences for like 10 years now and no other conferences. And I think it's good to get out and go to a different conference. I went to two podcast conferences this year and my God, are they a different experience? And they're so, like, the podcast movement in Anaheim, California was massive. And I mean, there were more people than show up at the SAAs, and there were people that flew across the country, paid, you know, it was like $400 or $500 to go to this conference just for the ticket. And which is more expensive than our conferences typically, just for the ticket. And they're just interested in podcasting. They just showed up because they're interested in podcasting. And the reason they went there is because there aren't just, you know, people talking about podcasting and different things, but there was actual classes and actual instruction and a lot of workshops and things like that. And that's one thing that I think is lacking an emphasis from our conferences. There are workshops, don't get me wrong. There are in-person workshops that you can do. A lot of times they happen a couple of days before the conference. Like a lot of times the SAA starts on a Thursday, and a lot of times on like a Wednesday, there'll be workshops and things like that if you want to show up early, but they're just not emphasized. They really are research driven. And I personally would like to see that change as we shift from conferences to being more of a networking opportunity. If I'm going to go, I need it to be more than just for networking, even though that's pretty powerful. I want to go and learn something while I'm there and not just about somebody's site. I can learn that from your blog. I can learn that from something else. You know, it's not going to really benefit me much. I mean, I can email you and you'll send me the paper if I know you. You know what I mean? So hearing you stand up there and read it, not you specifically, but any person stand up there and read it, is not very dynamic to me. I'd rather interact with you and talk about it. But I think we should have more teaching things at these conferences, but that's getting away from what's actually at a conference, because that's not, you know, you mentioned vendors too. I think that's one of the other great things that we have at conferences that could be better. I like seeing all the book vendors. Don't get me wrong. It's really neat to go through and see all the books, because they're a lot of the books that you see at these things are from, you know, university publishers, and you just don't see these in bookstores. Unless your bookstore is a university bookstore and it's the books that's been assigned by your teacher. But otherwise, they're just not stuff you see on the shelves at Barnes & Noble. You know what I mean? So it's really neat to go and look at those and browse. But aside from that, I think there could be a lot more things in the book room too, from more classes and, you know, just different types of things that could be there. So I don't know.
The other thing I think that is missing, and they're trying to make some effort to go back to is, and incorporate more in some of the conferences, is opportunities for dialogue. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons a lot of people like to do poster presentations is you can talk. You can talk to people. People stop and talk to you. When you do a paper presentation, you get to meet the other people in your session. And if it's thematically organized, you get to talk to them. Mm-hmm. And as an audience member, listening to these papers is really interesting, but you don't really have a chance to raise your hand at the end and say, okay, well, I have a question about this. Explain this to me. A lot of these conferences, because there's so many presenters now, because for academics and professional archaeologists, this is part of how we get jobs. It's part of how we build our professional portfolio, is going to these conferences, presenting our research. We are evaluated on that professionally and given raises and given hired based on how well we present and attend and participate and demonstrate our professionality. And so we're cramming these in, and we've lost a lot of the space to ask questions. And some of the smaller conferences I've been to, they still build that in because they have fewer presenters. And so they'll build in, you know, 4 presentations and then 15 minutes of question time.
Right.
And I think that that's something that's really valuable, because as a presenter, that's often where you get the opportunity to clarify things that maybe people didn't understand and you didn't know they wouldn't understand. Mm-hmm. And then as a listener, sometimes you just have questions and you want a little more information, and that's your chance. Or just to be able to discuss. Sometimes someone in the audience has some brilliant thoughts or ideas, and you can engage in really meaningful discussion about some of the topics.
Mm-hmm. April, can you explain what a poster is? Because I know people that might not be familiar with that are listening to this and going, poster? What the hell are you talking about? Like a movie poster?
So it's a giant research poster. Think of a PowerPoint presentation on a single sheet of paper. I think that's the best way.
Oh my God. I'm just going to print out a PowerPoint and put it on a poster. I think I'm going to actually do that.
Maybe that's not a good analogy. Okay, actually, you know what is making a better one? So sometimes on your Facebook feed, there are those informational like diagrams. It's kind of like that.
Oh, yeah.
So someone has taken a research topic or research paper or, you know, an article, a scientific article, or basically a news article, and they've distilled it down into key points. They generally have maybe 500 words on them. So it's a half-typed piece of paper. They're really visually heavy. And the idea is to present your research more in pictures and less in words. At least that's how they are supposed to be. So it's a single sheet. And these are, I mean, this isn't a small poster. These, I think they're like 3 feet by 5 feet, something like that is the maximum. So it's a small human being pinned to a wall.
Basically their size.
And it's really a visual presentation of someone's research. So it should have an introduction that tells you, oh, here's what their research question is. Here's how they're addressing that research question. Here are their methods, and here are their findings. All very visual, lots of pictures and graphs. And it should be interesting and easy to read. And it's a way of really quickly presenting research.
Yeah. Quick hack for anybody going to a conference this year. I saw somebody do this a few years ago, and I haven't presented a poster since I saw this happen. But if I do, I want to make sure I do it this way. But a lot of times when you're on the way to a conference, you can pick out the people that are going because of the big poster tubes that they're trying to get through the airport unsuccessfully and juggle their luggage and figure out how to do that. And you see all these poster tubes all over the place, because these posters are huge. I mean, they're really big. But this one guy, I'll never forget it. Eric Kanza, he's part of the DINA project, the Digital Index of North American Archaeology. He founded Open Context with his wife, Sarah Kanza. And I was standing with like probably 10 other people, and we're talking to him at the end of a poster session on a late poster, like the last one of the evening on a Thursday night at a conference. And I can't remember where the conference was, but it was one of the SAAs. And his poster's up, and it looks great. It's very vivid. I noticed right away that the color of it, like the whiteness of the white background, was a little bit different than the white of some of the other posters, and I couldn't really figure out why, but I wasn't really dwelling on it. And he's standing there, and when they finally kicked us out, like the support team, when they finally kicked us out, said, "You guys got to go." Eric, I didn't realize, only had his poster held up by two push bins in the corners. He pulled it off, wadded it up, and put it in his pocket. And well, he actually wore it for a cape for a second and then put it in his pocket because his poster was made of silk. Okay. He went to a website and had his poster printed onto silk so he could fold it up and put it in his suitcase.
Yeah. Cloth printing. Cloth printing is really big at conferences. Yeah. This is super nerdy and esoteric.
Oh my God.
But yeah. Oh, and just actually, you know what? That'd be so cool. If you printed all of your posters on cloth, you could make like giant quilts out of all your academic posters.
That's kind of awesome and amazing and nerdy all at once.
I don't think I'd allowed to have like six of those in my house, but someday.
I want to take donations. I want to take donations of people's cloth printed posters and make a quilt and give it away as like really a giveaway fun on the APN. All That's right, what I want to do.
Anyone listening, now you know what to do with your cloth printed poster that you weren't quite sure what you were going to do.
Right. The one that's sitting as a throw over your couch right now that doesn't really keep you warm because it's too thin. Yeah, that. Send it to me. Okay. Nice. Nice. All right. Well, I think in the last segment, we're going to get into some other stuff about when you actually do go to the conference. But let's talk about cost real quick. We have this as our last item, but let's move this up. And so we can talk about that. The cost of conferences, quite frankly, the most of the cost of a conference is just getting there and staying there. I've always had, I don't think I've ever stayed in the conference hotel, like the one that they say, here's the good, super awesome discount that brings the hotel cost down to $200 a night. I don't think I've ever stayed in the conference hotel just because of that. I've always stayed somewhere nearby, somewhere close by. With Airbnb and Uber, you can pretty much stay anywhere now and save a ton of money. That being said, there is something to be said for staying in the conference hotel, because a lot of times there's some late nights. You don't want to get in a car and drive somewhere, whether it's a rental or you drove there yourself, or, you know, maybe it's not in walking distance of the place you're staying. And it might be beneficial just to be able to, you know, walk up to your room and go to sleep and then wake up in the morning and do it all over again. So, but I know a lot of people, I guess what I'm saying isn't true. My very first conference I went to was a AAA in Chicago, and I was an undergrad and shared a suite in the Chicago Hilton Towers on Michigan Avenue, with like six other people because I was an undergrad and that's what you do. So it was, that's about the only way you can afford it though, because they're super expensive. But you know, if aside from the cost of airfare and hotel, you know, most of these conferences, you have to pay anywhere from $50 to $150 just to be a member of the organization. And then you pay about the same amount for the conference itself. Now, sometimes you can get a conference ticket. If you're not a member, you can get a non-member ticket. I believe the SAAs has that as a choice. I think the AAAs has that as a choice. I mean, the cost of it ends up being, why don't you just be a member and then get like the journal and stuff at the same time? You may as well if you're going to go that route. But if it's just a one-off for you and you don't want any of their spam emails or their printed journal or even their electronic journal, then just pay the non-member price and go once and see whether or not you like it. So I don't know. The regional ones and state ones are definitely cheaper. Like I think the Nevada Archaeological Association one is like $50 or something like that. It'd be super cheap. They just charge enough to pay for the room and they're done with it. And it's usually a little more cozy at the smaller ones too. Like I know the Nevada one, there isn't even separate rooms. Like all the papers are in one room spaced throughout the day and there's no gap. There's just like paper, 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 paper. And everybody's sitting in one spot. Everybody takes lunch together. Everybody takes breaks together. It's all in one thing. Whereas the SAAs, there's no way you could go to all the papers because there's 100 of them happening simultaneously at one point, especially during the real busy days like Thursday and Friday. So you pretty much have to pick which ones you're going to go to. So, all right. Anything else on cost and conferences before we close out this segment and talk about some other details?
No, I mean, the one thing I would say is sometimes check, You know, I've been to a conference that actually had something set up for room share. Oh, yeah. And so they would help pair you with someone else who's going to the conference who maybe didn't know anyone else going. So sometimes conferences have really great resources set up to help mitigate some of the costs that aren't the actual cost of attending, but are, you know, some of the travel or accommodation costs. If you're a student, sometimes they have travel grants that you can apply for that help cover the cost of those conferences. So always snoop around, and sometimes you get really lucky, and they're great ways of saving some money on going to those conferences.
Excellent point. Okay. Well, we're going to end this segment now, and we'll come back and tidy up this discussion on conferences with some do's and don'ts, both for your presentation and for your wardrobe. I'm just going to tell you right now, don't dress like Indiana Jones. All right. We'll be back in a second.
The CRM Archaeology Podcast brings together a panel of cultural resource management professionals to discuss the issues that really matter to the profession. Find out about networking strategies, job hunting, graduate programs, and much more. We'll often feature interviews with college professors, CRM business owners, and experts as well. Check out the show on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Let's get back to the show.
Okay, welcome back to episode 33, all about conferences. And we've talked about the types of conferences, what you're going to see at a conference, how much they cost, whether or not you can go. Now, let's just assume that you're going to a conference, whether you're a professional or not. And I mean a professional archaeologist or not. And this includes students and things like that, especially students. You always see students in like suits and things. They're very nervous. It's very cute. Anyway, we'll talk about wardrobe in a second. But I have to say something. As we transition from conference presentations being less about meeting somebody for the first time in a year, because you haven't seen them since the last conference, it's 2018, people. You've seen them. You've talked to them. You can Skype with them. You can literally have a video call with them. I'm really surprised we don't have like holograms of them sitting in front of us, just like Star Wars or something. But anyway, seeing somebody is not the big deal. So when you're considering your presentation, if it's a paper style presentation, and I don't know how deep we got into that, I don't remember, but there's like papers and forums and, you know, discussions and stuff. But the most common way to present at a conference is through, like April said, a 15-minute paper. And it's called a paper because people literally stand up there and read a paper. And I'll tell you what, the most boring thing you could ever sit through in your life is somebody who doesn't have a very dynamic voice reading through a paper. I've seen people read well. It can be done. But what's more enjoyable is when somebody who's, I love it when like the older professors get up there.
Yes.
Well, hey, let me just say, I can combine both of these into one story. So I saw at a conference, it was a small room, so there was only like 10 people in there. I don't even remember what the topic was, but this kid was up there, and I say kid, I mean, he was probably 20. He was an undergrad for sure, and he was, you know, dressed to the nines in a suit and really, really, really looking sharp, and he had his PowerPoint presentation up there. The little lectern was up right next to it, and he had his paper on there, and he was locked rigid with his arms right on that edge of that lectern. I mean, he was like standing there, not moving a muscle. You could see him sweating in that darkened room, and it was terrifying. And probably 4 or 5 minutes into the presentation, he just like paused, and because he got off on his slides and just couldn't figure it out. And he stopped moving. He stopped doing anything. And then he just like, without unbending his arms, started to fall over. Like he was literally passing out. And his professor was sitting in the front row watching him, like watching this happen, because the guy's not an idiot. He's seen it happen before. And he caught him. And the kid never really did pass out, but he literally just fell over from just sheer terror. And so the guy set him down and then proceeded to give one of the best papers I've ever seen in my life. He never went back to the kid's paper because he'd been mentoring him through it the whole time. He's standing up in front of the crowd. It was a small room, so he didn't need the microphone. And he was jamming through the slides, pointing up at the screen, doing different things, really being interactive with it. And that's people who really know their stuff, who are really into it. When they give that kind of presentation, that's what I love to see. When you get up there and you just read something, man, I am so uninterested. You know, like, I don't care about all the little minutiae of what you went through. Like, if I want to know that, I'll read it when it comes out in American Antiquity or wherever you're going to publish it. What I want to know is, what did you do? What were the results? What are your conclusions? And what are you going to do next? That's what I want to know. But a lot of times when people are reading a paper from slides, from a PowerPoint slide, or, you know, they've got their slides, they've got their paper, and they're just reading it, a lot of times they'll just run out of time before they get to the conclusions. And I don't know how many papers I've seen never even got to the conclusion section before they were cut off and run off stage. And then they're like, oh, you know, I'll email you my paper if you want to hear the rest. And I'm like, man, I could have done that to begin with. What the hell is you, what have you been doing the last 15 minutes? So, and then I'll...
So much passion.
Right. And then I'll end this rant with PowerPoint. My God, if I see another table of values that is in like 4-point font on a PowerPoint slide that doesn't even fit on the slide, like it goes off the top and the bottom over your like header text, what are you thinking? Like, were you just needed another slide? You know, I mean, don't do that. In fact, I tell people, and I don't do this myself, I don't even use PowerPoint anymore. I use Prezi, which is a much more engaging format. I hardly have any text. And if I have any text, they're very quick bullets. They're usually just pictures. And I know what I'm talking about, right? Like, I get up there and I talk and I have fun with it. I make sure my presentation is only about 10 or 12 minutes long so I can have time to interject some other things, maybe interact with the audience a little bit and just kind of have fun with it. I don't plan my presentation to be exactly 15 minutes long because I know that's not going to work out. And I don't want to screw somebody else by going over time because we're probably already late by the time it got to me. So... Oh, yeah, I'm glad I got that out. April.
I think that anyone who's been to more than two conferences has a similar passionate feeling, right. Unless maybe you're the perpetrators of some of these things and you're just not conscious of what's going on.
Right. If you don't know what we're talking about, you're the problem.
I'm going to spill a dirty little secret. A lot of the time when you're flying, you see the people with the poster tubes and you know they're going to your conference. And then you also see the people who are desperately writing their papers and putting together their PowerPoints on the airplane. And they are also going to your conference.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's brilliant. And they're doing it because they have given this presentation on this research topic in a different variation four other times. And they know this. And sometimes we're just running behind because we're doing 20 other things. So I tend not to do this because I'm very conscientious and I try not to read because that also then is my pet peeve. And if there's one thing that I tell undergrads that I work with to do, it is to go and take some theater classes or public speaking classes.
Mm-hmm.
Because the best papers are the people who have spent years speaking to public audiences or have a theater training and just have that ability to ad lib and wing it when things go horribly wrong. Because I'm going to say that one of the early conferences I went to, I was in an organized session and the people in the session before me covered about six of my slides.
Nice.
Giving sort of background that I was also planning on giving because I didn't know better. And lo and behold, you know, that was 5 minutes of what I was planning on talking about. And so there was no longer a point of half my, you know, a third of my PowerPoint. And, you know, I had two choices. I could give it all again or I could just wing it all. And I took option two. And I actually don't remember the rest of that presentation because I just sort of, much like the student who started to fall over backwards from fear, I sort of blacked out, but I was talking the whole time. So people said it was fine. But I don't, yeah.
I'm glad you took option number two because I've seen plenty of sessions that were themed sessions where, you know, oh, this is all about Yosemite National Park, just to throw something easy out there, you know, archaeological investigations at Yosemite. And there's like 10 papers on Yosemite and literally everybody gives the same 5 minute, you know, primer on Yosemite. Like, we've heard this before. Were you here for the last presentation? We know it's a national park. But they're so rigidly adhering to their own schedule, like they can't be flexible. Like they just can't get around it. So it's good to hear you were able to overcome that.
Yeah. And on the topic too, you know, there are people who don't do research I truly am passionate or interested about, but I go to listen to them talk at conferences because they're such amazing presenters.
Oh, yeah.
And I know who they are and I show up at their sessions and you can tell that everybody knows because their sessions are packed.
Yeah.
And their papers are just, you know, those are great. And that's how a good conference presentation should be. And I think, you know, I think this comes down to the fact that for a lot of people, presenting at a conference is just something mm-hmm. that you have to do. It's part of the professionalism. And it doesn't matter if you're a good presenter, if you want to present, or if you have something to present, you'll be there presenting. Oh, yeah. Because I've heard people present research plans. And you're like, yeah. Well, you haven't done this. This is just an idea. I mean, that's great, but
right.
This is what you bring up to a group of people at the bar. So
I think science communication is a huge problem in all scientific fields. And I guess it's less of a problem in some other fields where, you know, sure, if you're working on the next pill to cure cancer, you probably don't need to talk about it much. Just cure cancer and people will know who you were, right? But with us, with archaeologists, like literally nobody will know about the research that we're doing unless we tell people about it, right? Nobody's looking over our shoulders and, you know, maybe not the case of where you work, but I think people are actually looking over you guys' shoulders sometimes, like literally looking over your shoulders. But in a lot of cases, our archaeological sites and the things that we're talking about weren't even known until we discovered them or somebody else discovered them and never published on it. And then we went there and did more work. And now we're presenting this information. Nobody knows about it until we tell people about it. And if you can't tell people about it in an interesting or engaging way, well, then nobody's still going to know about it after you're done. I mean, I'm at the University of Nevada, Reno here. They always have really good lecture series. And in the past 3 or 4 years, I saw Brian Greene, who's a physicist, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Bill Nye all speak. And I'll tell you what, the reason they have books out, the reason they're on TV, the reason they get asked to come to conferences that you have to pay $20 to go see them speak at is because they're engaging. And it doesn't matter what they're saying. I honestly couldn't tell you what Neil deGrasse Tyson was talking about. I could listen to that man read the phone book and it would be awesome. I mean, he's Neil deGrasse Tyson, for Christ's sake. But we don't necessarily have that in archaeology, at least not in big, famous public circles. You know, we all know somebody who's probably like that. We all know maybe a professor or a paper we've seen, like you mentioned, April, that you know, this person was just amazing. But they don't have a PR firm behind them, so they're not out in the public and presenting this. So we have to all individually take up that mantle and go and present these things in our own way, in ways that we can, which is why I like to record presentations because, you know, the 30 people, if you're lucky, in the room that are hearing you, sure, they're benefiting from it, but literally nobody else will, because unless it was presented somewhere else, like on the Archaeology Podcast Network or wherever, you know, then you went through a lot of work. Like those people carry, you know, I almost envy posters more because they get to actually talk to more people and engage, but I really feel bad for the people you see out in the hall before they give their presentation, like finalizing their PowerPoint and all the stress they've gone through for this 15-minute presentation. And there's like 10 people in the room. That hurts. That really hurts, you know? So, all right, well, let's talk about, you've got a good point down here, and I'll let you take this one, April, on wardrobe and professional behavior, because this is a professional thing that you're going to. Typically, it's not a rock concert, although it can feel like it at an archaeology conference sometimes. But go ahead.
I'm going to say there's a huge range of dress, and you know, some of it really does depend on what kind of conference you're going to. If you're going to a small regional conference, they tend to be much more casual. But, you know, these big national conferences, are moderately formal affairs. You don't need your pocket square. You do see them, mm-hmm. but you probably don't need it. But it's also not necessarily the place you show up to, I think, in jeans and a t-shirt. Nice jeans and a button down, you can slide by on, especially if you're in, you know, tenured faculty. But, you know, wardrobe, I think really, you do see that whole range. You see the kind of very young undergrads and graduate students who are there on the job market, there to make an impression, get into school. You see older faculty or retired archaeologists who are just there. They're there to hear things and to socialize. But I think the general rule is dress decently, maybe business casual or mm-hmm. around there. Would you agree, yeah. Chris? That's kind of how I always go for it. It's business casual, unless I'm presenting, and then I kind of jump it up a notch.
I have evolved a little bit as I've gone along. I'll admit I wore a suit the first few times I went, or at least the tie and slacks. You know, sometimes the jacket's a little much depending on where the conference is. But
oh, yeah.
it's but yeah, nowadays it really just depends on what I'm doing. Like if I'm doing a session, we did a live, what was it at the last SA I went to, I think, was it in Orlando? I don't know, wherever it was. We did a live session. I called it a forum because that's the only thing SA had to actually fit that. But it was five of us up there recording and taking questions from the audience. So we did an actual recording, you know, and I'm pretty sure did we have APN shirts by then? I can't remember, but I would have had an APN shirt on. Yeah. Anyway, that's just to promote the brand, though. You know, I would have had an APN shirt on and probably something casual on underneath. But that's because that's the format. If you are standing up and you're giving a presentation and you're the only person standing up there, then you should probably dress the part. You know, I think some people go a little overboard wearing like a three-piece suit because I think the information should speak for itself. And, you know, you don't have to necessarily dress to the nines like that. But you're right. Don't show up in field clothes. Don't show up in... You know, not very nice. If you're in wearing jeans, you're like you said, wear nice jeans. You know, a nice jeans, a button down, or even a collared shirt and like a jacket, that doesn't look bad. You know? So,
oh yeah, nope. Yeah. Nice pair of shoes. I mean, the way I always look at it is that you are presenting yourself in a semi business professional setting, and so you want to present yourself in a way that garners respect from other people, where they will view you as someone to take seriously.
Yeah.
And I mean, at a certain point in many people's careers, everyone knows who you are and, you know, you've been taken seriously. Yeah. You've proven yourself. But, you know, at least for me, I'm still in the proving myself phase. So I probably shouldn't show up in a wrinkled t-shirt and, you know, whatever was on my bedroom floor.
Right. That's a really good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're actually in job seeking mode pretty much all the time as a graduate student. I mean, so you're making an impression on every single person that you meet there. But then you see those, you know, people that this is their 30th SAAs and they could just give a shit. No, they're usually older and they're dressed a little better, but honestly, they don't, I mean, they're tenured. They don't need to be, but one game I like to play is pick out the undergrad, because male undergrads, you can pick out. They haven't quite learned how to dress themselves in most cases, unless they're presenting. Maybe they've got a suit on, but they probably don't. And they probably are wearing something real sloppy, maybe wearing a hat kind of on crooked, or their hair's out of shape or something like that. Now, the women, however, they always seem to grow up way quicker and dress more professionally. And I don't know what that is, but I appreciate it. The women undergrads, they actually look really nice sometimes, especially when you see them presenting. But boys and guys, my God, are you kidding me? You know, just this is a conference. Leave your jersey at home. So
I'll also say that as a grad student, you know, I've noticed certain schools too, that, not sure it's necessarily the caliber of the school, but it seems like certain school students treat the conferences maybe with a little more seriously and show up dressed a little bit more professionally, or it's just something I've also noticed. And some of it is the culture of the different schools that people are at and how those schools are structured. So
right.
I enjoy it.
Yeah. I imagine that more competitive programs, people probably just are naturally driven to impress a little better and driven to, I don't know, step up their game a little bit, because they probably feel like they're in competition with their fellow students. And maybe they are. Maybe they are for certain resources at that college. I don't know. But, you know, they had to struggle to get into the program. So they're going to do everything they can to, you know, make themselves known while they're in the program.
Yeah. And, you know, this really gets, I think wardrobe helps us get to this idea of how do you get involved? Which to me is the scariest and hardest part of every single conference. because you would not know it from this podcast, I really struggle with talking to strangers. I know, shocking, right? Since that's what we do here on the Arcology podcast. But, you know, I think that's the most intimidating thing about these conferences for a lot of people is walking up to someone you don't know and saying, hi, I read your paper. It was fascinating. Or just talking to people. I mean, these are all people with common interest, but still, I don't know how you manage it. It's very intimidating, I think. but part of getting over that for me is feeling like I visually belong and I fit in and I can relax a little bit. at least in that way, you know, it's blending.
Right.
But yeah, no, I think talking to people is the hardest part of a conference and the most important part.
I think for me is not being a grad student anymore. And, you know, I own my company. I'm not going there looking for anything, really. I'm going there just to meet people and see interesting things and possibly record some interviews and things like that. So for me now, in my point in my career, like I've gotten over, I guess, being nervous about talking to people because I have nothing to prove or lose for that matter. So if I make an ass out of myself in front of someone, I'll just shake it off and then move on to the next person and keep on going. But you know, that's me. And you have to get to that point. And sometimes though, I mean, you really have to watch what you say and who you talk to. I mean, it's a pretty small field that we're in, despite the thousands of people you might see at that conference. People will remember you if you screw up or if you stand out in some sort of way that's not fortunate. You know, that definitely will stand out, which comes down a little more to professionalism as we tidy up this segment. Archaeology conferences are well known for, you know, running the at least the hotel bar, if not other local bars, dry of alcohol. Like, so that being said, don't make too much of an ass out of yourself. I mean, people go and they drink, and if you're around a whole crowd of people and this is your circle and that's what they're doing, sure, that's fine. But it's kind of a badge of honor to show up at that 9 o'clock presentation the next morning and be there. You know, don't roll out of bed at noon and show up in the afternoon. You know, I mean, maybe if you've got a paper and you want to prepare or something, that's fine. But, you know, have a late night, but have an early morning. That's conferences. And that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, well, I think we've nailed it. If you see any of us at a conference, please come up and say hi. I'm hoping to finalize in the next couple of weeks here having a booth at the SAAs. Again, it's a really expensive endeavor for us. Go to arcpodnet.com if you're listening to this. Right on the front page, I put a fundraiser just so I could throw it out there and see if anybody wanted to donate to help get us there, because we want to bring a whole bunch of stuff there as well. And getting that from Nevada to Washington, D.C. is not going to be cheap. I figure... just as we're talking about costs here with the booth and the conference and the hotel, the conference is going to cost the APN, well, me, probably about $2,200, give or take. And that's not going to be that. I think it's probably actually more than that because the booth is around $1,200 with power. So, you know, anything people can throw in, we'll take to help get us at the conference. And what gets us to the conference gets more information out to your ears, because we podcast there, we interview people there, we interview people and then post it that day and get it up so you can follow along with the conference in one small way with the Archaeology Podcast Network at our conference channel, by the way, arcpodnet.com/conferences. We only post stuff there from conferences. So, and in fact, if you're interested, I posted the five presentations that were at the podcasting session that I was part of at the American Association for Anthropological for Anthropology. I'm saying that wrong. The AAAs in Washington, D.C. So, and the SAAs coming up that we're going to is in Washington, D.C. at the same hotel, actually, the Marriott Wardman Park, whatever that is. I wish we could tell people to say hi to April at the SHAs, but sadly that will already have happened by the time you hear this. So anyway, hope you had a good time, April. And maybe on the next show, we'll talk about your experience at the SHAs.
Oh, all right.
Now you have to take notes.
I will talk to people. There we go.
This is your assignment. Talk to people and take notes. Nice. All right. Well, thanks, April. And thanks everybody else. And hope we see you at a conference soon.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning. Keep discovering new things and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.